Shinola. Men who believe that they are accomplishing something by speaking speak in a different way from men who believe that speaking is a waste of time. Bobby Shafto has learned most of his practical knowledge, how to fix a car, butcher a deer, throw a spiral, talk to a lady, kill a nip, from the latter type of man. For them, trying to do anything by talking is like trying to pound in a nail with a screwdriver. Sometimes you can even see the desperation spread over such a man's face as he listens to himself speak. Men of the other type, the ones who use speech as a tool of their work, who are confident and fluent, aren't necessarily more intelligent or even more educated. It took Shafto a long time to figure that out. Anyway, everything was neat and tidy in Bobby Shafto's mind until he met two of the men in Detachment 2702, Enoch Root and Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse. He can't put his finger on what bugs him about those two. During the weeks they spent together on Tagum, he spent a lot of time listening to them yammer at each other and began to suspect that there might be a third category of man, a kind so rare that Shafto never met any of them until now. Officers are discouraged from fraternizing with enlisted men and non-coms, which has made it more difficult for Shafto to pursue his research into the matter. Sometimes, though, circumstances jumble all of the ranks together willy-nilly. A prime example would be this Trinidadian tramp steamer. "Where do they get this stuff?" wonders Shafto. Does the U.S. government keep a bunch of Trinidadian tramp steamers riding at anchor at a naval yard somewhere, just in case one is needed? He thinks not. This one shows signs of a very recent and hasty change of ownership. It is a motherload of yellow, ragged, multi-ethnic pornography, some of it very run-of-the-mill, and some so exotic that he mistook it for medical literature at first. There is a lot of stray paperwork on the bridge and in certain cabins, most of which Shafto only sees out of the corner of his eye, as these areas tend to be the domain of officers. The heads are still littered with their predecessors' curly black pubic hairs, and the storage lockers are sparsely stocked with exotic Caribbean foodstuffs, most of them rapidly going bad. The cargo hold is filled with bales and bales of coarse brown fibrous material. Raw material for life preservers or bran muffins, he supposes. None of them much cares, because Detachment 2702 has been freezing its ass off in the far north ever since they left Italy a few months ago, and now they are running around shirtless, of all things. One little airplane ride, that's all it took, and they were in the balmy Azores. They did not get any R&R there. They went straight from the airfield to the Trinidadian ship in the dead of night, huddled under tarps in a covered truck. But even the warm air that streamed in underneath the tarp felt like an exotic massage in a tropical whorehouse. And once they steamed out of sight of port, they were allowed to come up above decks and take in some sun. This gives Bobby Shafto the opportunity to strike up a few conversations with Enoch Root, partly just for the hell of it, and partly so that he can try to figure out this whole business about the third category of men. Progress comes slowly.
"I don't like the word addict, because it has terrible connotations," Root says one day as they are sunning themselves on the afterdeck. "Instead of slapping a label on you, the Germans would describe you as morphiumsüchtig. The verb suchen means to seek, so that might be translated loosely as morphine-seeky, or even more loosely as morphine-seeking. I prefer seeky, because it means that you have an inclination to seek morphine."
"What the fuck are you talking about?" Shafto says.
"Well, suppose you have a roof with a hole in it. That means it is a leaky roof. It's leaky all the time, even if it's not raining at the moment. But it's only leaking when it happens to be raining. In the same way, morphine-seeking means that you always have this tendency to look for morphine, even if you're not looking for it at the moment. But I prefer both of them to addict, because they are adjectives modifying Bobby Shafto instead of a noun that obliterates Bobby Shafto."
"So what's the point?"
Shafto asks. He asks this because he is expecting Root to give him an order, which is usually what men of the talkative sort end up doing after jabbering on for a while. But no order seems to be forthcoming because that's not Root's agenda. Root just felt like talking about words. The SAS blokes refer to this kind of activity as wanking. Shafto has had little direct contact with that Waterhouse fellow during their stay on Tagum, but he has noticed that men who have just finished talking to Waterhouse tend to walk away shaking their heads, and not in the slow way of a man saying no, but in the sudden convulsive way of a dog who has a horsefly in his middle ear. Waterhouse never gives direct orders, so men of the first category don't know what to make of them. But apparently men of the second category fare no better. Such men usually talk like they have an agenda in their heads, and they are checking off boxes as they go. But Waterhouse's conversation doesn't go anywhere in particular. He speaks not as a way of telling you a bunch of stuff he's already figured out, but as a way of making up a bunch of new shit as he goes along. And he always seems to be hoping that you'll join in, which no one ever does, except for Enoch Root. After they've been out to sea for a day, the captain, Commander Eden, the same poor son of a bitch who got the job of ramming his previous command into Norway, staggers out of his cabin, making use of every railing or other handhold that comes within flailing distance. He announces in a slurred voice that from here on out, according to orders from on high, anyone going above decks must wear black turtlenecks, black gloves, and black ski masks underneath their other clothes. These articles are duly issued to the men. Shafto gets the skipper really pissed off by asking him 3 times whether he's sure he has the order worded correctly. One of the reasons Shafto is so highly regarded by the enlisted men is that he knows how to ask these kinds of questions without technically violating the rules of military etiquette. The skipper, to his credit, doesn't just pull rank and yell at him. He takes Shafto back to his cabin and shows him a khaki-covered army manual, printed in black block letters, Tactical Negro Impersonation, Volume 3, Negroes of the Caribbean. It is a pretty interesting order, even by Detachment 2702 standards. Commander Eden's drunkenness is also kind of disturbing. Not the fact that he is drunk, but the particular type of drunk. The sort of drunk of, say, a Civil War soldier who knows that the surgeon is about to remove his femur with a bucksaw. After Shafto has finished getting the turtlenecks, gloves, and ski masks passed out to the men and told them to simmer down and do the lifeboat drills again, Shafto finds Root in what passes for the sick bay. Because he figures it is time to have one of those open-ended conversations in which you try to figure out a bunch of shit, Root is his man.
I know you're expecting me to ask for morphine, but I'm not gonna, Shafto says. I just want to talk.
Oh, Root says. Should I put on my chaplain hat, then?
I'm a fucking Protestant. I can talk to God myself whenever I goddamn well feel like it.
Root is startled and bewildered by Shafto's burst of hostility.
Well, what do you want to talk about, Sergeant?
This mission.
Oh, I don't know anything about the mission.
Well, let's try to figure it out, then,
Shafto says. I thought you were just supposed to follow orders, Root says.
I'll follow them, all right.
I know you will.
But in the meantime, I got a lot of time to kill, so I might as well use that time to figure out what the fuck is going on. Now, Skipper says to wear this stuff if we are above decks, where we might be seen. But who the hell is going to see us out here?
An observation plane?
Germans don't have no observation planes, not out there.
Another ship?
Root asks rhetorically, getting into the spirit of the thing.
We'll see them at the same time they see us, and they'll give us plenty of time to put that shit on.
It would have to be a U-boat that the skipper is worried about, then.
Bingo,
Shafto says.
Because a U-boat could look at us through its periscope, and we'd never know we were being looked at.
But that day, they don't get much further in their attempt to figure out the deeper question of why their commanding officers want them to make themselves look like Negroes in the eyes of German U-boat captains. The next day, the skipper plants himself on the bridge, where he evidently means to keep a close eye on things. He seems less drunk, but no happier. He is wearing a colorful short-sleeved Madras shirt over a long-sleeved black turtleneck and rope sandals over black socks. Ever so often, he puts on his black gloves and ski mask and goes out to scan the horizon with binoculars. The ship continues westwards for a few hours after sunrise, then turns north for a short time, then heads east for an hour, then goes north again, then turns back to the west. They are running a search pattern, and Commander Eden does not appear to be looking forward to finding whatever it is that they are searching for. Shafto runs another lifeboat drill, then checks the lifeboats himself, making sure that they are lavishly stocked. Around noon, a lookout hollers. The ship changes course, headed roughly northeast. The skipper emerges from the bridge and, with an air of sepulchral finality, presents Bobby Shafto with a crate of dark brown shoe polish and a sealed envelope containing detailed orders. Minutes later, the men of Detachment 2702, under orders from Sergeant Shafto, strip to their briefs and begin coating themselves with shoe polish. They already own black shinola, which they are ordered to massage into their hair if it's not already black. Just another example of how the military screws the little man. Shinola ain't free.
"Do I look like a Negro yet?"
Shafto asks Root.
"I have traveled a bit," Root says, "and you don't look like a Negro to me. But to a German who has never seen the genuine article and who's looking through a periscope, what the heck?"
Then, "I take it you figured out the mission?"
"I read the fucking orders,"
Shafto says guardedly. They are headed towards a ship. As they get closer, Shafto checks it out with a borrowed spyglass and is startled but not really surprised to see that it's not one ship, but two ships side by side. Both of these ships have the long, fatal lines of U-boats, but one of them is fatter, and he figures it's a milch cow. Beneath his feet, he feels the engines throttling back to a dim idle. The sudden quiet and the palpable loss of momentum and power are not reassuring. He gets the usual sick, electric, nauseous, hyperactive feeling that always makes combat such a stimulating experience. The beat-up Trinidadian steamer has plied the waters of the Atlantic without incident throughout the war to date, running back and forth between African and Caribbean ports and occasionally venturing as far north as the Azores. Perhaps it has been sighted from time to time by a patrolling U-boat and judged to be not worth spending a torpedo on, but today its luck has changed for the worse. They have, by random chance, blundered across a milch cow, a supply U-boat of the Kriegsmarine of the Third Reich. The steamer's normally jaunty crew of shoe-brown Negroes has gathered at the rails to peer across the ocean at this peculiar sight, two ships tied together in the middle of the ocean, going nowhere. But as they draw closer, they realize that one of those ships is a killer, and that the other is flying the battle flag of the Kriegsmarine. Too late, they cut their engines. There is wild confusion for a minute or so. This might be an interesting spectacle to the lowly deck-swabbing Negroes, but the smart Negroes up on the bridge know they're in trouble. They've seen something they shouldn't have. They swing her around to the south and make a run for it. For an hour, they dash desperately across the sea, but they are trailed implacably by a U-boat, cutting through the waves like a Bowie knife. The U-boat has its whip aerial up. It's monitoring the usual frequencies and hears the Trinidadian steamer fire up her radio and send out an SOS. In a short stream of dits and da's, the steamer broadcasts her location and that of the milch cow, and in so doing, taps out her own death warrant.
Pesky Untermenschen. They've really gone and done it now.
It won't be 24 hours before the milch cow is located and sunk by the Allies. There is a good chance that a few U-boats will be hounded to their deaths as part of the bargain. That is not a good way to die, being chased across the ocean for several days, suffering the death of 1,000 cuts from strafings and bombings. Stuff like this really drives home to the common ordinary Ober-Torpedomat the wisdom of the Führer's plan to go out and find all of the people who aren't Germans and kill them. Meanwhile, our basic Kapitän Leutnant has got to be asking himself, what the hell are the chances that a tramp Trinidadian steamer is going to just happen upon us and our milch cow out in the vastness of the Atlantic Ocean? You could probably work it out, given the right data. N sub N equals number of Negroes per square kilometer. N sub M equals number of milch cows. A sub A equals area of the Atlantic Ocean. And so on. But wait a sec. Neither Negroes nor milch cows are randomly distributed, so the calculation becomes immensely more complicated. Far too complicated for a Kapitän Leutnant to mess around with, especially when he's busy trying to effect a dramatic reduction in N sub N. The Trinidadian steamer is brought up short by a shell fired across her bows from the U-boat's deck gun. The Negroes gather on the decks, but they hesitate, just for a moment, to launch the lifeboats. Perhaps the Germans are going to give them a break. Typical sloppy, sentimental Untermenschen thinking. The Germans brought them up short so they would hold still to be torpedoed. As soon as they realize this, the Negroes stage an impressive lifeboat drill. It's remarkable that they even have enough lifeboats to go around, but the calm, practiced skill with which they launch and board them is truly phenomenal. It's enough to make a German naval officer reconsider, just for a moment, his opinions about the shortcomings of darkies. It is a textbook torpedoing. The torpedo is set to run nice and deep, and as it passes underneath the ship, the detonation circuit senses a change in the magnetic field and triggers the explosive, neatly snapping the ship's keel, breaking its back, and sending it down with incredible speed. For the next 5 or 10 minutes, bales of brown stuff erupt from the water, released from the cargo holds as the ship plummets towards the bottom. It gives the whole scene an unexpectedly festive air. Some U-boat skippers would not be above machine-gunning the survivors at this point, just to let off a little steam. But the commander, Kapitän Leutnant Günter Bischoff, is not yet a card-carrying member of the Nazi Party, and probably never will be. On the other hand, Bischoff is wrapped in a straitjacket and blasted half out of his mind on drugs. Acting commander of the U-boat is Oberleutnant José Karl Beck. He is a card-carrying National Socialist, and in other circumstances he might be game for a bit of punitive machine-gunning, but at the moment he's exhausted and pretty badly shook up. He is intensely conscious of the fact that he's probably not going to live very long now that their location has been reported. So he doesn't. The Negroes are jumping out of the lifeboats, swimming to the bales and clinging to them with just their heads out of the water, realizing it would take forever to hunt them all down. O.L. Beck knows the Liberators and the Catalinas are already airborne and vectored towards him, so he has to get the hell out of there. Since he has plenty of fuel, he decides to head south for a while, planning to double back north in a day or two when the coast might be a bit clearer. It is the kind of thing that K.L. Bischoff would do if he had not gone crazy. And everyone on the boat has unlimited respect for the old man. They run on the surface, as they always do when they are not making a positive effort to sink a convoy, so they can send and receive radio messages. Beck gives one to Oberfunkmat Hofer, explaining what has just happened, and Hofer gives it to one of his Funkmats, who sits down in front of U-691's Enigma machine and encrypts it, using the key for the day, then taps it out on the radio. An hour later, they get a message back, straight from U-boat command at Wilhelmshaven. And when the Funkmat runs it through the Enigma, what he comes up with is, capture surviving officers. It's a classic example of military commandsmanship. If the order had come in a more timely fashion, it would have been easy to obey, but now that they are an hour away, it will be extremely difficult and dangerous. The order doesn't make any sense, and no effort is made to clarify it. Given the time lag, Beck figures he can get away with giving this one a half-assed try. He really should swing round and approach the wreck on the surface, which would get him there faster, but which would be nearly suicidal. So instead, he closes the hatches and descends to periscope depth as he draws closer. This cuts the U-boat's speed to a crawling 7 knots, so it takes them about 3 hours to get back to the atoll of bobbing brown bales that marks the site. A damn good thing, too, because another fucking submarine is there, picking up survivors. It is a Royal Navy submarine. This is so weird it makes the hairs on the back of Beck's neck stand up, and there's a lot of hair there because, like most submariners, Beck hasn't shaved in weeks. There's nothing weird, though, that can't be settled with a single well-placed torpedo. Seconds later, the submarine explodes like a bomb. The torpedo must have touched off her munitions. Her crew and most of the rescued Negroes are trapped within and don't have a chance of getting out even if they survived the explosions. The submarine drops off the surface of the ocean like the wreckage of the Hindenburg tumbling down on New Jersey.
Gott in Himmel, Beck mumbles, watching this all through the periscope.
He had been pleased by the success until he'd remembered that he had specific orders and that killing everyone in sight was not one of them. Will there be any survivors for him to pick up? He takes the U-boat up onto the surface and climbs up on the conning tower with his officers. First thing they do is scan the skies for Catalinas. Finding none, they post lookouts, then begin to nose the U-boat through the sea of bales, which by now has spread out to cover at least a square kilometer. It is getting dark, and they have to bring up searchlights. All looks rather dismal until one searchlight picks out a survivor. Just a head, shoulders, and a pair of arms reaching up, clenching a rope around a bale. The survivor does not move or respond as they approach, and not until a wave rolls the bale over is it revealed that everything below the man's solar plexus has been bitten off by sharks. The sight sets even this hardened crew of murderers to gagging. In the quiet that ensues, they hear low voices echoing across the calm water. With a bit more searching, they find 2 men, evidently talkative sorts, sharing a bale. When the searchlight picks them out, one of the Negroes lets go of the bale and dives beneath the surface. The other just stares calmly and expectantly into the light. This Negro's eyes are pale, almost colorless, and he has a skin condition. Parts of him are turning white. As they draw closer, the pale-eyed Negro speaks to them in perfect German.
"My comrade attempts to drown himself," he explains.
"Is that even possible?"
asks Kapitän Leutnant Beck.
"He and I were just discussing that very question."
Beck checks his wristwatch.
"He must want to kill himself very badly," he says. "Sergeant Shafto takes his duty very seriously. It's kind of ironic. His cyanide capsule dissolved in the seawater."
"I am afraid that all irony has become tedious and depressing to me," Beck says,
as a body breaks the surface nearby. It is Shafto, and he seems to be unconscious.
"You are?"
Beck asks.
"Lieutenant Enoch Root. I'm only supposed to take officers," Beck says,
casting a cold eye in the direction of Sergeant Shafto's back.
"Sergeant Shafto has exceptionally broad responsibilities," says Lieutenant Root calmly. "In some respects, exceeding those of a junior officer."
"Guess them both. Fetch the medicine box. Revive the sergeant," Beck says. "I will talk to you later, Lieutenant Root."
And then he turns his back on the prisoners and heads for the nearest hatch. He is going to spend the next week trying very hard to stay alive, in spite of the best efforts of the Royal and United States Navies. It's going to be quite an interesting challenge. He should be thinking about his strategy. But he can't get the image of Sergeant Shafto's back out of his mind. His fucking head was still underneath the water. If they weren't about to fish him out of the ocean, he would have succeeded in drowning himself. So it was possible. At least for one person. Hostilities. As the vans, taxis, and limousines pull into the parking lot at the Ministry of Information site, the members of Epiphyte Corp are greeted by smiling and bowing Nipponese virgins wearing and bearing gleaming white Goto engineering helmets. The time is about 8 in the morning, and up here on the mountain, the temperature is still tolerable, though humid. Everyone mills around before the cavern's maw, carrying their hard hats in their hands, as no one wants to be the first to put his on and look stupid. Some of the younger Nipponese executives are mugging hilariously with theirs. Dr. Mohammed Pragasu circulates. He has an authentically used and battered hard hat, which he whirls absentmindedly around one finger as he strolls from group to group.
"Has anyone simply asked Prag what the fuck is going on?" says Eb.
He rarely uses English profanity, so when he does, it's funny. The only member of Epiphyte Corp who does not, at least, crack a smile is John Cantrell, who has been looking distant and tense ever since yesterday.
"It's one thing to write a dissertation about mathematical techniques and cryptography," he said on the way up here when someone asked him what was bothering him, "and another to gamble billions of dollars worth of other people's money on it."
"We need a new category," Randy said. "Other bad people's money."
"Speaking of which,"
Tom began, but Avi cut him off by glaring significantly at the back of the driver's head. To dwarf@siblings.net. From root@arutatorium.org. Subject, re-3-y. "Randy, you ask me to justify my interest in why you are building the crypt. My interest is a mark of my occupation. This is, in a sense, what I do for a living. You continue to assume that I am someone you know. Today you think I'm the dentist. Yesterday you thought I was Andrew Loeb. This guessing game will rapidly become tedious for both of us, so please believe me when I tell you that we have never met. Begin Ordo Signature Block, etc. End Ordo Signature Block." To root@arutatorium.org. From dwarf@siblings.net. Subject, re-4-y. "Damn. After you said you did it for a living, I was going to guess that you were Geb, or another one of my ex-girlfriend's crowd. Why don't you tell me your name?" Begin Ordo Signature Block, etc. End Ordo Signature Block. To dwarf@siblings.net. From root@arutatorium.org. Subject, re-5-y. "Randy, I've already told you my name, and it meant nothing to you. Or rather, it meant the wrong thing. Names are tricky that way. The best way to know someone is to have a conversation with them. Interesting that you assume I'm an academic." Begin Ordo Signature Block, etc. End Ordo Signature Block. To root@arutatorium.org. From dwarf@siblings.net. Subject, re-6-y.
"Gotcha! I didn't specify who Geb was, and yet you knew that he and my ex-girlfriend were academics. If, as you claim, I don't know you, how do you know these things about me?"
Begin Ordo Signature Block, etc. End Ordo Signature Block. Everyone now turns to look towards Prag, who seems to be having trouble with his peripheral vision today.
"Prag is avoiding us," Avi snaps, "which means it will be completely impossible for us to reach him until after this is all over."
Tom steps towards Avi, drawing the corporate circle in closer.
"The investigator in Hong Kong?"
"Got some IDs, struck out on others," Avi says. "Basically, the heavyset Filipino gentleman is Marcos's bagman, responsible for keeping the famous billions out of the hands of the Philippine government. The Taiwanese guy, not Harvard Lee, but the other one, is a lawyer whose family has deep connections to Japan, dating back to when Taiwan was part of their empire. He has held down half a dozen government positions at various times, mostly in finance and commerce. Now he's sort of a fixer who does jobs of all sorts for high-ranking Taiwanese officials."
"What about the scary Chinese guy?"
Avi raises his eyebrows and heaves a little sigh before answering.
He's a general in the People's Liberation Army, equivalent to a 4-star rank. He's been working their investment arm for the last 15 years.
Investment arm? The Army?
Cantrell blurts. He's been getting uneasier by the minute, and now looks mildly nauseated. The People's Liberation Army is a titanic business empire, Beryl says. They control the biggest pharmaceutical company in China, the biggest hotel chain, a lot of the communications infrastructure, railways, refineries, and obviously armaments.
What about Mr. Cellphone? Randy asks.
Still working on him. My man in Hong Kong is sending his mugshot to a colleague in Panama. I think that after what we saw in the lobby, we can make some assumptions, Beryl says. Half an hour ago, as Epiphyte Corp was gathering in the lobby, a big black Mercedes came in, fresh from the airport. 747s come into Kinakuta 4 times a day, and from the time that a person presents himself at the registration desk of his luxury hotel, you can figure out which city he flew in from. These guys came in from Los Angeles. 3 Latino men, a middle-aged fellow of great importance, a somewhat younger assistant, and a palooka. They were met in the lobby by the solitary fellow who showed up late yesterday with the cell phone. 2. Dwarf@siblings.net. From root@eruditorium.org. Subject, Re-7-Y. Randy, you ask how I know these things about you. There are many things I could say, but the basic answer is surveillance. Begin auto-signature block, etc. End auto-signature block. Randy figures there's no better time to ask this question. And because he's known Avi longer than anyone else, he's the only one who can get away with asking it.
Do we really want to be involved with these people? He says. Is this what Epiphyte Corp is for? Is this what we are for?
Avi heaves a big sigh and thinks about it for a while. Beryl looks at him searchingly. Eb and John and Tom study their shoes or search the triple canopy jungle for exotic avians while listening intently. You know, back in the 49er days, every gold money town in California had a nerd with a scale, Avi says. The assayer. He sat in an office all day. Scary-looking rednecks came in with pouches of gold dust. The nerd weighed them, checked them for purity, told them what the stuff was worth. Basically, the assayer's scale was the exchange point, the place where this mineral, this dirt from the ground, became money that would be recognized as such in any bank or marketplace in the world, from San Francisco to London to Beijing. Because of the nerd's special knowledge, he could put his imprimatur on dirt and make it money. Just like we have the power to turn bits into money. Now, a lot of the people the nerd dealt with were incredibly bad guys. Peghouse habitués, escaped convicts from all over the world, psychotic gunslingers, people who owned slaves and massacred Indians. I'll bet that the first day or a week or month or year that the nerd moved to the gold mining town and hung out his shingle, he was probably scared shitless. He probably had moral qualms, too. Very legitimate ones, perhaps. Avi adds, giving Randy a sidelong glance. Some of those pioneering nerds probably gave up and went back east. But you know what? In a surprisingly short period of time, everything became pretty damn civilized, and the towns filled up with churches and schools and universities, and the sort of howling maniacs who got there first were all assimilated or driven out or thrown into prison, and the nerds had boulevards and opera houses named after them. Now, is the analogy clear?
The analogy is clear, Tom Howard says.
He is less troubled by this than any of them, with the possible exception of Avi, but then his hobby is collecting and shooting rare automatic weapons. No one else will say anything. It is Randy's job to be troublesome. How many of those assayers got gunned down in the street after they pissed off some psychotic gold miner? He asks.
I don't have any figures on that, Avi says.
Well, I am not fully convinced that I really need this, Randy says. We all need to decide that question for ourselves, says Avi.
and then vote as a corporation whether to stay in or pull out, right? Randy says. Avi and Beryl look meaningfully at each other.
Getting out at this point would be, complicated, Beryl says.
Then, seeing a look on Randy's face, she hastens to add, not for individuals who might want to leave Epiphyte. That's easy, no problem. But for Epiphyte to get out of this,
situation,
Cantrell offers. Dilemma, Randy says. Eb mumbles a word in German. Opportunity, Abby counters.
Would be all but impossible, Beryl says.
Look, Abby says, I don't want anyone to feel compelled to stay in a situation where they have moral qualms.
Or fear imminent summary execution, Randy adds helpfully.
Right. Now, we've all put a ton of work into this thing, and that work ought to be worth something. To be totally above board and explicit, let me reiterate what is already in the bylaws, which is that anyone can pull out. We'll buy back your stock. After what's happened here in the last couple of days, I'm pretty confident that we could raise enough money to do so. You'd make at least as much as if you had stayed home doing a regular salaried job.
Younger, less experienced high-tech entrepreneurs would have scoffed bitterly at this. But everyone on this crew actually finds it impressive that Avi can put a company together and keep it alive long enough to make it worth the work they put into it. The black Mercedes cruises up. Dr. Mohamed Pragasu strides over to meet it, greets the South Americans in fairly decent Spanish, makes a couple of introductions. The scattered clumps of businessmen begin to draw closer together, converging on the cavern's entrance. Prag is making a head count, taking attendance. Someone's missing. One of the dentist's aides is maneuvering towards Prag in lavender pumps, a cell phone clamped to her head. Randy breaks away from Epiphyte and sets a collision course, reaching Prague's vicinity just in time to hear the woman tell him,
Dr. Kepler will be joining us late. Some important business in California. He sends his apologies.
Dr. Pragasu nods brightly, somehow avoids eye contact with Randy, who is now close enough to floss Prague's teeth, and turns, clamping his hard hat down on top of his glossy hair.
Please follow me, everyone,
he announces.
The tour begins.
It is a dull tour, even for those who have never been inside the place. Whenever Prague leads them to a new spot, everyone looks around and gets their bearings. Conversation lulls for 10 or 15 seconds, then picks up again. The high-ranking executives stare unseeingly at the hewn stone walls and mutter to each other, while their engineering consultants converge on the Goto engineers and ask them learned questions. All of the construction engineers work for Goto and are, of course, Nipponese. There is another who stands apart.
Who's the heavyset blonde guy? Randy asks Tom Howard.
German civil engineer on loan to Goto. He seems to specialize in military issues.
Are there any military issues?
At some point, about halfway into this project, Bragg suddenly decided he wanted the whole thing bomb-proof.
Oh. Is that bomb with a capital B, by any chance?
I think he's just about to talk about that,
Tom says, leading Randy closer. Someone has just asked the German engineer whether this place is nuclear-hardened.
Nuclear-hardened is not the issue, he says dismissively. Nuclear-hardened is easy. It just means that the structure can support a brief overpressure of so many megapascals. You see, half of Saddam's bunkers were technically nuclear-hardened. But this does no good against precision-guided penetrating munitions, as the Americans proved. And it is far more likely this structure will be attacked in that way than that it would ever be nuked. We do not anticipate that the Sultan will get involved in a nuclear war.
This is the funniest thing that anyone has said all day, and it gets a laugh.
Fortunately, the German continues, this rock above us is far more effective than reinforced concrete. We are not aware of any earth-penetrating munitions currently in existence that could break through.
What about the R&D the Americans have done on the Libyan facility? Randy asks.
You're talking about the gas plant in Libya, buried under a mountain,
the German says, a bit uneasily, and Randy nods.
That rock in Libya is so brittle. says the German. You can shatter it with a hammer. We are working with a different kind of rock here, in many layers.
Randy exchanges a look with Avi, who looks as if he is about to bestow another commendation for deviousness. At the same time Randy grins, he senses someone's stare. He turns and locks eyes with Prague, who is looking inscrutable, verging on pissed off. A great many people in this part of the world would cringe and wither under the glare of Dr. Mohammed Pragasu, but all Randy sees is his old friend, the pizza-eating hacker. So Randy stares right back into Prague's black eyes and grins. Prague prepares for the stare-down.
You asshole! You tricked my German! For this you shall die!
But he can't sustain it. He breaks eye contact, turns away, and raises one hand to his mouth, pretending to stroke his goatee. The virus of irony is as widespread in California as herpes, and once you're infected with it, it lives in your brain forever. A man like Prague can come home, throw away his Nikes, and pray to Mecca 5 times a day, but he can never eradicate it from his system. The tour lasts for a couple of hours. When they emerge, the temperature has doubled. 2 dozen cell phones and beepers sing out as they exit the radio silence of the cavern. Avi has a brief and clipped conversation with someone, then hangs up and herds Epiphyte Corp towards their car.
Small change of plans, he says. We need to break away for a little meeting.
He utters an unfamiliar name to the driver. 20 minutes later, they are filing into the Nipponese Cemetery, sandwiched between 2 busloads of elderly mourners.
Interesting place for a meeting, says Eberhard Furr.
Given the people we're dealing with, we have to assume that all of our rooms, our car, the hotel restaurant, are bugged,
Abby snaps. No one speaks for a minute, as Abby leads them down a gravel path towards a secluded corner of the garden. They end up in the corner of 2 high stone walls. A stand of bamboo shields them from the rest of the garden and rustles soothingly in a sea breeze that does little to cool their sweaty faces. Beryl's fanning herself with a Kinnikutin street map.
Just got a call from Annie in San Francisco, he says.
Annie in San Francisco is their lawyer.
It's, 7 p.m. there right now. Seems that just before the close of business, a courier walked into her office, fresh off the plane from L.A., and handed her a letter from the dentist's office.
He's suing us for something, Beryl says.
He's this far away from suing us.
For what?
Tom Howard shouts. Abby sighs.
In a way, Tom, that is beside the point. When Kepler thinks it's in his best interest to file a tactical lawsuit, he'll find a pretext. We must never forget that this is not about legitimate legal issues. It is about tactics.
Breach of contract, right? Randy says. Everyone looks at Randy.
Do you know something we should know?
Asks John Cantrell.
Just an educated guess, Randy says, shaking his head.
Our contract with them states that we are to keep them informed of any changes in conditions that may materially alter the business climate.
That's an awfully vague clause, Beryl says reproachfully.
I'm paraphrasing.
Randy's right, Abby says. The gist of this letter is that we should have told the dentist what was going on in Kinnikuta.
But we did not know, says Eb.
Doesn't matter. Remember, this is a tactical lawsuit.
What does he want?
To scare us, Abby says. To rattle us. Tomorrow or the next day he'll bring in a different lawyer to play good cop, to make us an offer.
What kind of offer?
Tom asks. We don't know, of course, Abby says. But I'm guessing that Kepler wants a piece of us. He wants to own a part of the company.
Light dawns on the face of everyone, except Avi himself, who maintains his almost perpetual mask of cool control.
So, it's bad news, good news, bad news. Bad news number one, Anne's phone call. Good news? Because of what has happened here in the last 2 days, Epiphyte Corp is suddenly so desirable that Kepler is ready to play hardball to get his hands on some of our stock.
What's the second bit of bad news? Randy asks.
It's very simple.
Avi turns away from them for a moment, strolls away for a couple of paces until he is blocked by a stone bench, then turns to face them again. This morning I told you that Epiphyte was worth enough, now that we could buy people out at a reasonable rate. You probably interpreted that as a good thing. In a way, it was. But a small and valuable company in the business world is like a bright and beautiful bird sitting on a branch in a jungle, singing a happy song that can be heard from a mile away. It attracts pythons. Avi pauses for a moment. Usually the grace period is longer. You get valuable, but then you have some time, weeks or months, to establish a defensive position before the python manages to slither up the trunk. This time, we happened to get valuable while we were perched virtually on top of the python. Now we're not valuable anymore.
What do you mean? Eb says. We're just as valuable as we were this morning.
A small company that's being sued for a ton of money by the dentist is most certainly not valuable. It probably has an enormous negative value. The only way to give it a positive value again is to make the lawsuit go away. See, Kepler holds all the cards. After Tom's incredible performance yesterday, all of the other guys in that conference room probably wanted a piece of us just as badly as Kepler did. But Kepler had one advantage. He was already in business with us, which gave him a pretext for filing the lawsuit. So I hope you enjoyed our morning in the sun, even though we spent it in a cave. Avi concludes. He looks at Randy and lowers his voice regretfully. And if any of you were thinking of cashing out, let this be a lesson to you. Be like the dentist. Make up your mind and act fast.
Funkspiel. Colonel Chetton's aide shakes him awake. The first thing Waterhouse notices is that the guy is breathing fast and steady, the way Alan does when he comes in from a cross-country run.
Colonel Chetton requests your presence in the mansion most urgently.
Waterhouse's billet is in the vast makeshift camp, 5 minutes' walk from Bletchley Park's mansion. Striding briskly, whilst buttoning up his shirt, he covers the distance in four. Then, 20 feet from the goal, he is nearly run over by a pack of Rolls Royces, gliding through the night as dark and silent as U-boats. One comes so close that he can feel the heat of its engine. Its muggy exhaust blows through his trouser leg and condenses on his skin. The old farts from the Broadway buildings climb out of those Rolls Royces and precede Waterhouse into the mansion. In the library, the men cluster obsequiously round a telephone, which rings frequently and, when picked up, makes distant tinny shouting noises that can be heard but not understood from across the room. Waterhouse estimates that the Rolls Royces must have driven up from London at an average speed of about 9,000 miles per hour. Long tables are being looted from other rooms and chivied into the library by glossy-haired young men in uniform, knocking flecks of paint off the door frames. Waterhouse takes an arbitrary chair at an arbitrary table. Another aide wheels in a cart of wire baskets piled with file folders, still smoking from the friction of being jerked out of Bletchley Park's infinite archives. If this were a proper meeting, mimeographs might have been made up ahead of time and individually served. But this is sheer panic, and Waterhouse knows instinctively that he'd better take advantage of his early arrival if he wants to know anything. So he goes over to the cart and grabs the folder on the bottom of the stack, guessing that they'd have pulled the most important one first. It is labeled U-691. The first few pages are just a form. U-boat data sheet, consisting of many boxes. Half of them are empty. The other half have been filled in by different hands using different writing implements at different times, with many erasures and crossouts and marginal notes written by bet-hedging analysts. Then there is a log containing everything U-691 is ever known to have done in chronological order. The first entry is its launch at Wilhelmshaven on September 19, 1940, followed by a long list of the ships it has murdered. There's one odd notation from a few months ago, refitted with experimental device, Schnorkel. Since then, U-691 has been tearing up and down like mad, sinking ships in the Chesapeake Bay, Maracaibo, the approaches to the Panama Canal, and a bunch of other places that Waterhouse, until now, has thought of only as winter resorts for rich people. Two more people come into the room and take seats. Colonel Chatton, and a young man in a disheveled tuxedo who, according to a rumor that makes its way around the room, is a symphonic percussionist. This latter has clearly made some effort to wipe the lipstick off his face, but has missed some in the crevices of his left ear. Such are the exigencies of war. Yet another aide rushes in with a wire basket filled with ultra-message decrypt slips. This looks like much hotter stuff. Waterhouse puts the file folder back and begins leafing through the slips. Each one begins with a block of data identifying the Y station that intercepted it, the time, the frequency, and other minutiae. The heap of slips boils down to a conversation, spread out over the last several weeks, between two transmitters. One of these is in a part of Berlin called Charlottenburg, on the roof of a hotel at Steinplatz, the temporary site of U-Boat Command, recently moved there from Paris. Most of these messages are signed by Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz. Waterhouse knows that Dönitz has recently become the supreme commander-in-chief of the entire German Navy, but he has elected to hold on to his previous title of commander-in-chief of U-boats as well. Dönitz has a soft spot for U-boats and the men who inhabit them. The other transmitter belongs to none other than U-691. These messages are signed by her skipper, Kapitänleutnant Günther Bischoff. Bischoff, sank another merchantman. This newfangled radar shit is everywhere. Dönitz, acknowledged. Well done. Bischoff, bagged another tanker. These bastards seem to know exactly where I am. Thank God for the Schnorkel. Dönitz, acknowledged. Nice work as usual. Bischoff, sank another merchantman. Airplanes were waiting for me. I shot one of them down. It landed on me in a fireball and incinerated three of my men. Are you sure this Enigma thing really works? Dönitz, nice work, Bischoff. You get another medal. Don't worry about the Enigma. It's fantastic. Bischoff, I attacked a convoy and sank three merchantmen, a tanker, and a destroyer. Dönitz, superb. Another medal for you. Bischoff, just for the hell of it, I doubled back and finished off what was left of that convoy. Then another destroyer showed up and dropped depth charges on us for 3 days. We are all half dead, steeped in our own waste, like rats who have fallen into a latrine and are slowly drowning. Our brains are gangrenous from breathing our own carbon dioxide. Dönitz, you are a hero of the Reich, and the Führer himself has been informed of your brilliant success. Would you mind heading south and attacking the convoy at such and such coordinates? P.S. Please limit the length of your messages. Bischoff. Actually, I could use a vacation, but sure, what the heck? Bischoff. A week later. Nailed about half of that convoy for you. Had to surface and engage a pesky destroyer with the deck gun. This was so utterly suicidal they didn't expect it. As a consequence, we blew them to bits. Time for a nice vacation now. Dönitz, you are now officially the greatest U-boat commander of all time. Return to Lorient for that well-deserved R&R. Bischoff, actually I had in mind a Caribbean vacation. Lorient is cold and bleak at this time of year. Dönitz, we have not heard from you in 2 days. Please report. Bischoff, found a nice secluded harbor with a white sand beach. Would rather not specify coordinates as I no longer trust security of Enigma. Fishing is great, and working on my tan. Feeling somewhat better. Crew is most grateful. Dönitz, Günther, I am willing to overlook much from you. But even the Supreme Commander-in-Chief must answer to his superiors. Please end this nonsense and return home. U-691.
This is Oberleutnant José Carl Beck, second in command of U-691. Regret to inform you that K.L. Bischoff is in poor health. Request orders. P.S. He does not know I am sending this message. Dönitz. Assume command. Return not to Lorient, but to Wilhelmshaven. Take care of Gunther. Beck. K.L. Bischoff refuses to relinquish command. Dönitz. Sedate him and get him back here. He will not be punished. Beck. Thank you, on behalf of me and the crew. We are underway, but short of fuel. Dönitz. Rendezvous with U-413, a milch cow, at such and such coordinates. Now more people come into the room. A wizened rabbi, Dr. Alan Matheson Turing. A big man in a herringbone tweed suit whom Waterhouse remembers vaguely as an Oxford Don. And some of the naval intelligence fellows who are always hanging around Hut 4. Chatton calls the meeting to order and introduces one of the younger men, who stands up and gives a situation report. U-691, a type IXD/42 U-boat, under the nominal command of Kapitän Leutnant Gunther Bischoff and the acting command of Oberleutnant José Carl Beck, transmitted an Enigma message to U-boat command at 2000 hours Greenwich time. The message states that 3 hours after sinking a Trinidadian merchantman, U-691 torpedoed and sank a Royal Navy submarine that was picking up survivors. Beck has captured 2 of our men, Marine Sergeant Robert Shafto, an American, and Lieutenant Enoch Root, Anzac.
How much do these men know?
Demands the Don, who is making a stirringly visible effort to sober up. Chatton fields the question.
If Root and Shafto divulged everything that they knew, the Germans could infer that we are making strenuous efforts to conceal the existence of an extremely valuable and comprehensive intelligence source. Oh, bloody hell,
the Don mumbles. An extremely tall, lanky, blonde civilian, the crossword puzzle editor of one of the London newspapers, currently on loan to Bletchley Park, hustles into the room and apologizes for being late. More than half of the people on the ultra-mega list are now in this room. The young naval analyst continues.
At 21:10, Wilhelmshaven replied with a message instructing O.L. Beck to interrogate the prisoners immediately. At 01:50, Beck replied with a message stating that, in his opinion, the prisoners belonged to some sort of special naval intelligence unit.
As he speaks, carbon copies of the fresh message decrypts are being passed round to all the tables. The crossword puzzle editor studies his with a tremendously furrowed brow.
Perhaps you covered this before I arrived, in which case I apologize, he says. But where does the Trinidadian merchantman come into all of this?
Chatton silences Waterhouse with a look and answers,
I'm not going to tell you.
There is appreciative laughter all around, as if he had just uttered a bon mot at a dinner party.
But Admiral Dönitz, reading these same messages, must be just as confused as you are. We should like to keep him that way.
Datum 1. He knows a merchant marine was sunk, pipes up Turing, ticking off points on his fingers. Datum 2. He knows a Royal Navy submarine was on the scene a few hours later and was also sunk. Datum 3, he knows 2 of our men were pulled out of the water, and that they are probably in the intelligence business, which is a rather broad categorization as far as I am concerned. But he cannot necessarily draw any inferences, based upon these extremely terse messages, about which vessel, the merchantman or the submarine, our 2 men came from.
Well, that's obvious, isn't it? Says Crossword Puzzle. They came from the submarine.
Chatton responds only with a Cheshire grin.
Oh,
says Crossword Puzzle. Eyebrows go up all around the room.
As Beck continues to send messages to Admiral Dönitz, the likelihood increases that Dönitz will learn something we don't want him to know, Chatton says. That likelihood becomes a virtual certainty when U-691 reaches Wilhelmshaven intact.
correction?
Hollers the rabbi. Everyone is quite startled, and there is a long silence while the man grips the edge of the table with quivering hands and rises precariously to his feet.
The important thing is not whether Beck transmits messages. It is whether Durnitz believes those messages.
Hear, hear, very astute, Turing says.
Quite right. Thank you for that clarification, Herr Kahn,
Chatton says.
Pardon me for just a moment, says the Don. But why on earth wouldn't he believe them?
This leads to a long silence. The Don has scored a telling point and brought everyone much back to cold, hard reality. The rabbi begins to mumble something that sounds rather defensive, but is interrupted by a thunderous voice from the doorway.
Funkspiel!
Everyone turns to look at a fellow who has just come in the door. He is a trim man in his 50s, with prematurely white hair, extremely thick glasses that magnify his eyes, and a howling blizzard of dandruff covering his navy blue blazer.
Ah, good morning, Elmer,
Chatton says, with the forced cheerfulness of a psychiatrist entering a locked ward. Elmer comes into the room and turns to face the crowd.
Funkspiel!
He shouts again, in an inappropriately loud voice, and Waterhouse wonders whether the man is drunk or deaf or both. Elmer turns his back to them and stares at a bookcase for a while, then turns around to face them again, a look of astonishment on his face.
I was expecting a chalkboard to be there,
he says in a Texarkana accent.
What kind of classroom is this?
There is nervous laughter around the room as everyone tries to figure out whether Elmer is cutting loose with some deadpan humor or completely out of his mind.
It means radio games, says Rabbi Kahn.
Thank you, sir,
Elmer responds quickly, sounding pissed off.
Radio games! The Germans have been playing them all through the war. Now's our turn.
Just moments ago, Waterhouse was thinking about how very British this whole scene was, feeling very far from home, and wishing that one or two Americans could be present. Now that his wish has come true, he just wants to crawl out of the mansion on his hands and knees.
How does one play these games, Mr.?
Says Crossword Puzzle.
You can call me Elmer,
Elmer shouts. Everyone scoots back from him. Elmer, Waterhouse says, would you please stop shouting? Elmer turns and blinks twice in Waterhouse's direction.
The game is simple,
he says in a more normal conversational tone. Then he gets excited again and begins to crescendo.
All you need is a radio and a couple of players with good ears and good hands.
Now he's hollering. He waves at the corner where the albino woman with the headset and the percussionist, with the lipstick on his ear, have been huddled together.
You want to explain fists, Mr. Shales?
The percussionist stands up.
Every radio operator has a distinctive style of keying. We call it his fist. With a bit of practice, our Y-service people can recognize different German operators by their fists. We can tell when one of them has been transferred to a different unit, for example.
He nods in the direction of the albino woman.
Miss Lord has intercepted numerous messages from U-691 and is familiar with the fist of that boat's radio operator. Furthermore, we now have a wire recording of U-691's most recent transmission, which she and I have been studying intensively.
The percussionist draws a deep breath and screws his courage up before saying,
We are confident that I can forge U-691's fist.
Turing chimes in. And since we have broken Enigma, we can compose any message we want, and encrypt it just as U-691 would have.
Splendid, splendid,
says one of the Broadway buildings guys.
We cannot prevent U-691 from sending out her own legitimate messages,
Chatton cautions, short of sinking her, which we are making every effort to do. But we can muddy the waters considerably. Rabbi?
Once again, the rabbi rises to his feet, drawing everyone's attention as they wait for him to fall down. But he doesn't.
I have composed a message in German naval jargon. Translated into English, it says, roughly, interrogation of prisoners proceeding slowly, request permission to use torture, and then there are several X's in a row, and then is added the words, warning, ambush, U-691 has been captured by British commandos.
Sharp intakes of breath all around the room.
Is contemporary German naval jargon a normal part of Talmudic studies?
Asks the Don.
Mr. Khan has spent a year and a half analyzing naval decrypts in Hut 4,
Chatton says.
Here's the lingo down pat.
He goes on.
We have encrypted Mr. Khan's message using today's naval enigma key and passed it on to Mr. Shales, who has been practicing.
Miss Lord rises to her feet, like a child reciting her lessons in a Victorian school, and says,
I am satisfied that Mr. Shales's rendition is indistinguishable from U-691's.
All eyes turn towards Chatton, who turns towards the old farts from the Broadway buildings, who even now are on the phone relaying all this to someone of whom they are clearly terrified.
Don't the Jerrys have huffed off?
Asks the Don, as if probing a flaw in a student's dissertation.
Their Huff-Duff network is not nearly so well developed as ours, responds one of the young analysts. It is most unlikely that they would bother to triangulate a transmission that appeared to come from one of their own U-boats, so they probably won't figure out the message originated in Buckinghamshire rather than the Atlantic.
However, we have anticipated your objection, Chatton says. And made arrangements for several of our own ships, as well as various aeroplanes and ground units, to flood the air with transmissions. Their Huff-Duff network will have its hands full at the time of our fake U-691 transmission.
Very well,
mutters the Don. Everyone sits there in churchly silence, while the most senior of the Broadway building's contingent winds up his conversation with who is at the other end. After hanging up the phone, he intones solemnly,
You are directed to proceed.
Chatton nods at some of the younger men, who dash across the room, pick up telephones, and begin to talk in calm, clinical voices about cricket scores. Chatton looks at his watch.
It will take a few minutes for the Huff-Duff smokescreen to develop. Miss Lord, you will notify us when the traffic has risen to a suitably feverish pitch.
Miss Lord makes a little curtsy and sits down at her radio.
Funkspiel!
Shouts Elmer, scaring everyone half out of their skins.
We already done sent out some other messages. Made them look like Royal Navy traffic. Used a code the crowds just broke a few weeks ago. These messages have to do with an operation. A fictitious operation, you know, in which a German U-boat was supposedly boarded and seized by our commandos.
There is a whole lot of tinny shouting from the telephone. The gentleman, who has the bad luck to be holding it, translates into what is probably more polite English. What if Mr. Shales's performance is not convincing to the radio operators at Charlottenburg? What if they do not succeed in decrypting Mr. Elmer's false messages? Chatton fields that one. He steps over to a map that has been set up on an easel at the end of the room. The map depicts a swath of the Central Atlantic bordered on the east by France and Spain.
U-691's last reported position was here, he says, pointing to a pin stuck in the lower left corner of the map. She has been ordered back to Wilhelmshaven with her prisoners. She will go this way, he says, indicating a length of red yarn stretched in a north-northeasterly direction, assuming she avoids the Straits of Dover.
This is dry humor,
and is received as such by everyone in the room. At this point in the war, a U-boat could no more run up the English Channel than it could travel up the Mississippi, sink a few barges in Dubuque, and make its escape.
"There happens to be another milch cow here," Chatton continues, indicating another pin. "One of our own submarines should be able to reach it within 24 hours, at which point it will approach at periscope depth and engage it with torpedoes. Chances are excellent that the milch cow will be destroyed immediately. If she has time to send out any transmissions, she will merely state that she is being attacked by a submarine. Once we have destroyed this milch cow, we will call once again upon the skills of Mr. Shales, who will transmit a fake distress call that will appear to originate from the milch cow, stating that they have come under attack from none other than U-691.
"Splendid,"
someone proclaims.
"By the time the sun rises tomorrow," Chatton concludes, "we will have one of our very best submarine hunting task forces on the scene. A light carrier with several anti-submarine planes will comb the ocean night and day using radar, visual reconnaissance, Huff-Duff, and Lee lights to hunt for U-691. The chances are excellent that she will be found and sunk long before she can approach the continent. But should she find her way past this formidable barrier, she will find the German Kriegsmarine no less eager to hunt her down and destroy her. Any information she may transmit to Admiral Dönitz in the meantime will be regarded with the most profound suspicion."
"So," Waterhouse says, "the plan, in a nutshell, is to render all information from U-691 unbelievable, and subsequently to destroy her and everyone on her before she can reach Germany."
"Yes," Chatton says. "And the former task will be greatly simplified by the fact that U-691 skipper is already known to be mentally unstable."
"So it seems likely that our guys, Shafto and Root, will not survive," Waterhouse says slowly. There is a long, frozen silence, as if Waterhouse had interrupted High Tea by making farting sounds with his armpit. Chatton responds in a precise, arch tone that indicates he's really pissed off.
"There is the possibility that when U-691 is engaged by our forces, she will be forced to the surface and will surrender."
Waterhouse studies the grain of the tabletop. His face is hot, and his chest is burning. Miss Lord rises to her feet and speaks. Several important heads turn toward Mr. Shales, who excuses himself and goes to a table in the corner of the room. He fiddles with the controls on a radio transmitter for a few moments, spreads the encrypted message out in front of himself, and takes a deep breath, as though preparing for a big solo. Finally, he reaches out, rests one hand lightly on the radio key, and begins to tap out the message, rocking from side to side and cocking his head this way and that. Miss Lord listens with her eyes closed, concentrating intensely. Mr. Shales stops.
"Finished," he announces in a quiet voice, and looks nervously at Miss Lord, who smiles.
Then there is polite applause around the library, as if they had just finished listening to a harpsichord concerto. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse keeps his hands folded in his lap. He has just heard the death warrant of Enoch Root and Bobby Shaftoe.